It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
I like podcasts that seem to take place over coffee. Well, today's conversation is over coffee in more ways than one. I have the obligatory cup of coffee on the table, and we're getting ready to talk about coffee grown in the USA, particularly grown in the Central Coast of California. I want to welcome Jay Ruskey, the CEO of Fringe Coffee. Jay, am I saying it right? Because it's F-R-I-N-J. It sounds very Californian. Do you mean it to be Fringe?
Yeah. Hi, Roger. Fringe Coffee is just it is how it's spelled. I'm not the best speller in the world. I always do things a little bit different, and I think that is a fair representation of what this company is about. We like to do things different, but still stay connected. I think growing coffee in California, we're really like 11 degrees north of the Tropic of Cancer, which is generally the northern boundary of the coffee growing region. And so we weren't supposed to grow coffee here, and we have been. And so I think Fringe is a representation of just that. Plus my team and I, we're always pushing the technical boundaries of farming anyways. So kind of all plays into what we're doing. I hope that also the coffee experience that we're giving people is on the edge too. I've talked a little bit about coffee already, but trying to change the perspective a little bit on how we approach our cup of coffee, and then add the respect back to the farmer is the ultimate experience, because I care for the farm and I care for my cup of coffee.
The company itself, now you actually have a coffee that you are marketing, is it primarily in your area?
We are the first commercial coffee farm in California. Goodland Organics is my farm. And for a little background for listeners, I started this coffee business 20 years ago. And then I had other farmers that liked what I was doing with coffee with avocados. And so we expanded to that. So now we represent many coffee farms in California. My main goal is in making sure that the farmer has a profitable experience and profitable crop. So originally, most of my coffees went to Japan and to get the highest return for what we were doing, because we went through great efforts in the early days with not a lot of resources. Yeah. Today, we're selling as direct as we can get. We've basically taken the most complicated food chain on the planet and gone farmer, fringe to the customer. So online, where you can buy coffee if you have a grinder, which I know you do, You can buy it at Fringe Coffee and get it directly to the farmer, and 60% of what you buy goes back to the farmer. We do have coffee shops in California, like Bird Rock in San Diego. We did a lot of coffees through them. And I still have some demand in Japan. And so I'm trying to balance making sure people have a good retail experience, but also being able to go as direct possible to probably one of the most direct food sources we consume every day.
There's just always some market in Japan for having something really interesting and unique with a great story. They kind of led the charge. We think that we invented, I think, good stories behind our food. But boy, for years, there's been discerning customers, I think, on different food items in Japan that looked at something really special, and they really were interested in giving it a try. And it sounds like they're even finding, again, coffee from California to enjoy right now, too.
There's a lot of different ways we can look at the Japanese market, but the one way I try to approach it is their craftsmanship. You know, you can go to Japan, you can go, someone will have a third generation broom maker, you know, who makes the best brooms in the world. And they appreciate that type of craftsmanship. And for me, I'm proud because we grow our own coffee. I even breed my own coffee. We spend 4 years getting it to crop. We take incredible care with the post-harvest. And then we sort it and we ship it and we make sure they go to the best roasters. So for me, that runs parallel to what the Japanese market really likes, a well-crafted, cared-for coffee. And so so that was a big push for me to continue that and try to be the best crafted coffee in the world. And I think we got there, and we still now have to expand that through mini growers and continue that push.
Is there anywhere else in the United States other than Hawaii that grows coffee?
No. This is, Southern California is the only place that I know of. We generally farm only in the avocado belt. Avocados and coffee share very similar environmental and soil conditions. And so I've always used that as a guide. Right now, with the current varieties we have, we just got to stay within that Southern California, coastal Southern California area.
So when I think of coffee regions around the world, oftentimes I think of them being in sort of hills or mountains, or is, and yet I don't think of avocados quite to the same extent. I see more avocados in Southern California. This flatter ground, it's not what I would think of, looks like the commercials for coffee grown around the world, but maybe that's just a fiction that you need hills or altitude or, you know, sloping facing sun or something.
Well, a couple of things on that front. First, avocados are generally grown on slopes in Southern California because we still get periodic frosts. Usually, you know, you'll see the lemons on the bottom and the avocados on the foothills because the cold air settles. So to some degree, we need that elevation to protect us from frost. But in the tropics, where there's a really rapid, it's warm, the lowland full sun coffees have about a 7-month maturation period. It's rather rapid. And the quality, it's high yielding, but the quality it's hard to get in what we call specialty grade. So farmers will take their coffees and add shade or elevation, which cools them down. And so that 6-7 months gets expanded to like 8-9 months. And they get a slower development. They get a riper cherry. It's actually, coffee's a fruit, and it has a very sweet cherry fruit around it. And quality goes up, but yield will begin to drop a bit because of those conditions. Well, in California, we mimic that through latitude. And so we don't need high elevation. We just use the latitude, and we get in a full sun coffee. We can get 12 months of maturity from flower to harvest, just because we flower when we have really long daylight hours in the summer. And then the maturation period going through winter is a very slow process because of not as much sunlight, a little cooler temperatures, like if you're on top of a mountain. And then we finish our coffees through maturity, turning red and sweetening, and where we have 15 hours of dry conditions. The other difference, since I'm on this topic, is we irrigate and furigate, where most coffees rely on periodic rainfall.
When are you picking these?
We generally peak in late July, August for our coffees.
What do you do with them then? I mean, when you get the beans, do they have to go in cold storage and wait a certain time before it goes to the next stage? What happens after you pick them?
Well, and this is what I call the blind spot in coffee, right? No one knows what happens. Right. And which is one of my intentions, is to try to educate people on this part, because it's really where you have to be careful. It's a fruit, like a lot of fruits, when you harvest it, there's like a time clock, you know, because it starts breaking down. And so for us, we go as quickly as possible into what we call a wet mill, which is a depulper. And so the skin is released, and usually 1 to 3 seeds, generally 2 seeds, pop out of the coffee. And the seed is surrounded by what we call a mucilage, which is the fruit. And it's rather slimy. It's sugary. And so the skin goes away either to compost or some other product that we're working on. And then that mucilage has to go through a process to remove. And so we go through a fermentation period, and that fermentation is controlled, be up to 5 days, where we have to stir it, and times we put yeast in it. And that removes that mucilage, which is easier to drying, but also creates some flavor components. And then we go for a 1-week to 2-week drying period. And then it goes to a mill because it has a shell like a peanut. Remove that. And then it goes to a green bean, which we have to sort out. And then it's ready for roasting after about a 2-month waiting period for curing.
Wow.
It's the process.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I feel a lot better about spending more than $3 for a plain cup of black coffee.
Yeah, I mean, there are farms that have machines that pick everything, strip the coffee, machines that like process. Instead, we take 5 days, they'll take 12 hours. They'll dry it in 2 days on huge machines that are big dryers, where we take a week or two because that doesn't destroy the coffee. And then other coffees go on big ships and they're in the commodity trade and the futures trade. And there's no, that gets, can sit there for in a port for a year. So it's different routes. And so I'm glad you feel there is a responsibility, like, because it is one of the most difficult coffee or foods we make. I in fact have a winemaker who's the director of our post harvest, and he's, the first year he's like, wow, this is so much more complicated than wine. And it is, but people don't know that.
Well, and it is a fruit, like you're saying, this is kind of like the seed of a fruit in a way. I mean, I've talked to somebody before that was taking what they called that fruit part of it. And I think they call it, was it like coffee cherries or something?
Yeah.
And they use it for other ingredients. And it was really high nutrition.
Yeah.
It's more value.
I think there's a lot of value. Some days I think the coffee plant's been hiding that fact for us. And I'm trying to expose the fact that there is a coffee cherry. It's just, it's high in sugars, and most of the coffee processing mills aren't designed to preserve fruit. They're designed to get that seed out for a highly stable world trade market. But we are active in trying to create products. I think I have a responsibility to our farmers to make this fruit that we work so hard on to bring it to another level. So we are looking at supplements because the antioxidants and some of the other chemical compounds are potentially better for us than even blueberries. And so we have UC Davis Food Science really looking into that right now. And there's plenty of stuff on the internet, but I think because we're in California, we can more easily support this in the post-harvest system because we have sanitation conditions, we're certified organic, we're in stainless steel vats. We have all that there that a lot of most of the world in traditional coffee processing regions don't have. And so part of the fringe goal is to care for that extra product and make some teas and make some supplements out of it.
So the people that decide I might try to grow coffee, like you said, they might be in an area that's doing avocados currently. So it's probably typically your farmers are people that are already farming, I suppose, where some other, there's a lot of products in agriculture these days, especially where people are trying to provide something that is a local artisan and so forth. But is it more likely that they're already commercial farmers of some sort that would say, let me try coffee too, or expand and have something else to grow? So let's get into, is that the typical farmer?
Yeah. I mean, right now we have 67 farms in California that is part of the Fringe Network and over 85,000 trees in the ground. Of those farmers, I'd say 1/3 are professional farmers. That have other products, mainly avocados, lemons, oranges, tangerines. And so they get it, and they are looking for a diversification strategy, knowing that, especially like lemons are a commodity, you know, slow margin. You get a disruption in the food service right now, and there's no room to make anything. And so how are they going to move forward? The other group, small farmers, small avocado farms. I mean, most avocado farms in the state of California average about 5 acres. So those margins are pretty low. It doesn't make sense to them. So trying to do a regenerative strategy with them is key, and giving them a high value product is a great goal. We do have a portion of our farmers that are new, and that's great. I'm looking forward to trying to help a new farmer. We have a lot of advisory and support for the conversion of their lifestyle, because it's a major lifestyle shift. And so the coffee culture is something I'm trying to get there. But We, in agriculture in Southern California, have to look at value added in the small farm basis. So this is a lot more like wine. You know, when you buy a French coffee, you are buying the label of the farm, you know, who they are, the variety, where they're from. And so, and that's good for them, and it adds value to them, the farm, and hopefully it adds value to the consumer who's enjoying it because he knows that it's something that is close. I mean, we've sold coffees at Bird Rock that were grown 30 miles from, or less than 30 miles from the coffee shop in San Diego. I mean, it's a great, it makes that coffee taste so much better, but, ultimately, this is about the farmer and their culture and giving them opportunity to make it work. I have to say there are some really great farmers, and there's some farmers that, you know, that you got to help along a little bit more.
In your program, you're guaranteeing a pretty high percentage back to the farmer themselves, whereas the model, and maybe the reason that fair trade is talked about so much on international sourcing, is that there's a lot of people growing coffee around the world that are just barely sustaining themselves, and yet by the time it hits the international markets, it's pretty high price. Not much gets back to farmers is what I'm saying. It's interesting that your model is putting a line in the sand and saying that you're going to get this money that we're making, you're going to share, or yeah, we're sharing with you, I guess.
Thank you for recognizing that. Not just me and my fringe team all have drawn that line on purpose. I've been farming for 30 years. I've done avocados, lemons, cherimoyas, I have finger limes. I have all these crops, and I've experienced the supply chain. I also have a degree in ag business marketing, so I've studied the supply chains, and it's always leaving the farmer out. And then when you get to coffee, it's like the ultimate abuse to the farmer, because they're getting, if they're lucky, 5% of the total value. And it's probably worse now. And so here we are enjoying one on a regular basis, these cups of coffees, but there's so many nodes along the way that are diluting that, where it's coming from and how to get money back. Generally, the retailer has the ability to do the ultimate marketing and get paid for that. But still there's these barriers. And so at the very least, what Fringe can do is, you know, start drawing that, not just coffee, but let's start taking care of our production system. From a growing standpoint, I'm trying to establish an industry that never existed before in California. And it starts with our farmers. And so right now, if we, you know, farmers are investing 4 years, think about this, you plant a seed, prepare the ground, you get 4 years before your first crop and payment, that's a major investment. And so to have a bigger return in the beginning helps them justify the investment. It also helps them expand. If they start getting paid better, they'll buy more trees, and we can all grow this industry together while kind of making a point the same way. And this is that opportunity for us to do it. So,
Well, you know, that's interesting. I got to reminisce, I guess, on something else that I go back to. Years ago, I went to an environmental meeting. I was involved in an environmental meeting in Nairobi, Kenya. A bunch of the Kenyan coffee farmers invited me to have dinner with them and brainstorm on how they could get a bigger share of the value of coffee, because, you know, that just wasn't working out. They were, you know, there was a monopoly that was buying the coffee from them. Yep. And it never quite, I was never able to quite help them. But I still remember to this day sitting around the table with these Kenyan farmers and just wishing that they could get something on track. And now I'm thinking about all these years later talking to you and these farmers here in California, kind of a different stage, but they also had the advantage of having a market close at hand.
Yeah.
And in your case, some direct lines that it's encouraging.
Thank you. It's super complex. Like, it took me years to figure out what's really happening in the coffee market. I still don't know everything, but I know that this can happen in California, and maybe it's the beginning of something bigger, you know, and how we can get more direct. I think with the change in marketplace, how we ship things, I think it's the beginning of other things. And it's one of many of our initiatives in Fringe, you know, to bring to the new market to do something different and live up to our name. I'm glad you recognize that and you brought that up. And I hope to make some, if I can make some little change in the industry because of what we're doing here in California, that would be a win for us.
If you've got the land, and some of the coffee is organic, so it would have to, it'd have to be land that hadn't, you know, well, I guess it's a while before you get it. But tell me what it looks like. So you've got a stretch of, I don't know, it's several acres or something like this. Preparing the ground and planting these seeds or shrubs or whatever, kind of help me see that because I'm really ignorant about this.
My favorite way is to go into old avocado groves and convert them and leave some avocados for windbreaks and soil conversions.
So you pull the trees out.
I actually like to pull, our, if they're big trees, we cut them back and regenerate them, but we pull, you know, 60 to 80% of them, but leaving rows of windbreaks and some other income production. So we're not leaving that acreage without some level of production.
Right.
I have this layered system that I've been working on. But say we have a raw piece of land, we're going to come in there. First, we got to plant the seeds. So my company has a breeding program where we recognizing that there's really no big breeding programs in the world of coffee. We started one. So we get good plant material lined up. It takes about a year for the plant to be ready to be planted. Meanwhile, the ground is being prepped. Ideally, we're incorporating organic matter into that through compost or mulch, bringing in water and irrigation, which is exact same demand, if not a little less than avocados. We plant generally in spring and early summer, which the plants are about 24 inches tall, and then we care for them. And that means nutrition through the irrigation, mulching, weed control. And it'll be about 2.5-3 years, generally 3 years conservatively, to first flower. It flowers, then we wait 12 months for harvest. So now you're in year four. Harvest comes, you got about 4 months of processing. Generally, my company likes to, what we do, we pay a little bit. We do a shared revenue, so we pay a little bit beginning to cover costs. And then when we sell the coffee, it's a percentage of that, because if it's really good, it'll high. And then we pay the farmer back through that. So it's a 5-year program, and avocados are about that, lemons, certainly wine grapes. So
the pistachios, almonds, a lot of those.
Pistachios are 6-7 years out. Yeah. So you're really, to be a perennial farmer, you have to have a lot of patience. But I also think when we keep reflecting back to the industry as a whole, I mean, you have farmers who have 30- or 40-year-old trees that they're farming. You're asking them, here, we have a brand new hybrid that's more productive. It's better in the specialty market. I'm sorry the market hasn't given you any profits in the last 3 years, but plant this new plant and let's wait 4 years and I guarantee you'll get profitable. It's a really hard conversion.
How did you pick out like what varieties are going to be producing the quality that you want and also kind of what uniquely fits to California, because you're still in kind of virgin territory. It's a new enough industry.
So crop adaptation is something I've been doing for a while with the University of California with multiple crops. I've worked with lychees. I've worked with truffle trees. I've worked with dragon fruit. And so it's important, you know. So luckily 22 years ago, I got some varieties of coffee and some about 12 varieties, and I planted them out. And over a course of 10 years, I've tried them out, looking at yield evaluation. In 2014, I was approached by Dr. Juan Medrano from UC Davis, and he realized that there really hadn't been any sequencing of the coffee around the world. Like all of our food crops actually have some type of genetic understanding. So we went through, we got a grant, and we actually sequenced one of our trees. And during that process, we went and reevaluated the varieties that I had, which were common varieties. And we realized certain plant materials are better than others and that there's a lot of genetic drifting going on. So through that, we've selected trees through architecture, how they grow bigger, to cupping, which is the standard for coffee evaluation, and looked at the market. And so over the last few years, we've used those drivers as saying these are the geisha, which can get hundreds of dollars a pound. It's not as strong, but we know that's a great market. And then we have Catuai Rojo, which is genetically very developed, but it's a workhorse. It's a little more resistant. So that's an example of, well, we put those two on the farm because we know we've diversified the farm and we have some high-end capabilities. As we move forward, 4 years ago, I started taking those genetic tools and finding, selecting parents to crossbreed. We do traditional breeding, but we use genetics to kind of better understand what the best selection is instead of just guessing. And so we are now rolling out new hybrids, and we found that they're very susceptible to what we call F1 or hybrid vigor, so you can get more vigor out of them. So ultimately, in the next couple of years, we can do like geisha hybrids and varieties that are more predictable to grow, stronger, and give us better outcomes. And this is desperately needed around the world. There's not a lot of breeding research. Again, most coffees are grown in regions that don't have the education and the research resources that we have in California. And so starting with our California farmers, we're trying to create newer varieties. I am trying to look at frost tolerance, because that would better open up regions that are not favorable today. We do look at quality and yield. Those are our main drivers. Some of the other breeding organizations are more focused on disease, but California doesn't have the traditional diseases, so we kind of have a unique angle to plant material right now. And so that's kind of like a walkthrough of how we do this. I mean, any coffee plant you buy from us has its own individual code, in which I can trace back to the exact plant it came from and maybe trace back where that plant came from. So I have this lineage that we've started in the last 4 years that I don't really see in any other crop.
Well, I love that. You know, there's such a waiting game getting started in this. And so you're getting these, getting them planted, and it takes a while to get any return. But once you kind of get going, can you give me any kind of like ballpark kind of what kind of income a coffee grower might be able to produce off of a, I don't know, an acre worth of coffee?
Yeah. You know, every farm's a little different, and we're doing a lot more regenerative work where we're doing layered systems. So we take those avocados or other crops and incorporate the coffee. So from a per plant basis, you're really, we have an estimate that there's about a pound and a half dry weight of coffee per plant. And the average return that we're getting to our farmers is over $80 a pound, or that's what we're selling the coffee for. And then we give 60% back to them on that. So you're really looking into the $50 range per pound. And so they're gaining, and it will cost them about $25 to $30 a pound to produce today. Those numbers are going down because we're planting better farms, more efficient, better plant material. So we're gaining some economies of scale. So ultimately, you're gaining on a per acre basis. I want to move the farmer from an avocado or lemon basis where you're gaining, you know, a 9, 10% return on the good years to more like a 25% return, if not higher, if they can get some quality on their production.
And their cost, what do you need, 3 or 4 feet of water to produce these?
Today, that's what I generally require. I kind of fall along the avocado guidelines, but there's a real shift going on since the drought where we're using a lot more technology to manage the water. All our farms need to have automated capabilities or near automated capabilities. I think we'll take another big jump in technology here in the next 2 or 3 years where we'll be able to better control our water. I think sensors are pretty affordable nowadays. So we're becoming a lot more efficient in our use of water. I always say a farmer knows when to turn the water on, but not always when to turn it off. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where my focus is. It's like, all right. I would like to have ultimately a system. We get these strange hot winds in the middle of the night here. And so be able to just, it just turns on because there's a call for water. That's what, when the plant needs it, not out of the convenience of the farmer. He has to wake up in the morning. I'll go turn on water in the morning. It needs to be real time. And that also creates a more efficient use of time. So we're also looking at, we have some regenerative work. We're looking at, work with Gavio Coastal Conservation Group, and we got a grant from them where we're looking at the overall acre and the soil health, the water holding capacity. That's because of organic matter through cover crops, through leaf layer from the top story of trees. And so we're basically trying to make the soils more efficient in the use of the water for the plant. And I think that's a parallel course that we're headed towards on water optimization.
What about the microbial life? Are you seeing any correlation in starting to pay attention to the microbes and having any variation either in production or quality or anything like that as you're looking at the health of the soil?
Yes. I did study truffles years ago, so I always like, what's going on with the root system? And there seems to be, we came out with what we call the fourth wave of coffee, the coffee science, you know, like what's really going on. Microbes are really been, I've seen this focus in the coffee world, not only in the soil, but also in the fermentation process. Really, no one up till about 3 years ago really studied what was going on. And maybe it's also we haven't had the technology like we do today. We're doing things now. We're planting today, and we've pre-inoculated our plants with endomycorrhizal to help better adapt them to.
So you're getting bacteria someplace and getting it into the soil.
Yeah, I'm actually being active on this component. Now that we have multiple farms producing, we begin to see highlight and see that some farms are more diversified, ferment differently. I do believe there is some terroir component and quality to microbes. I think we have a good pathway to better understanding it and manipulating it. But at the same point, I'm also trying to accelerate that, because if we're coming into land that needs help and we really have a regenerative approach, it's one thing to plant other trees and to get some soil, get some cover crops, and let it kind of happen naturally. But I think now we have some affordable technologies where we can actually, pre-inoculate and accelerate that so that we can kind of meet in the middle.
Man, I have so many questions. It's really interesting what you're doing. One quick thing I think we should mention
sure.
Labor. Because I would think when you're planting these, there's a certain amount of maybe of trimming and keeping the water systems going. But I would imagine that you need extra labor at harvest time for most of these operations.
Yeah, I mean, harvest is the biggest individual cost right now for coffee. I mean, it's upwards towards $10 a pound. I think we have farmers and crews that can do better than that today, but we're pretty conservative. So that's a leading question. I'm sure the listeners are going, yeah, what about, labor? And, we're here in California. We actually have pretty good labor even compared to Hawaii. I mean, Hawaii really has labor constraints. All around me, we have blueberries production, raspberry production, and all of those are very labor intensive to harvest. In fact, you have to, when a raspberry is ready to harvest, you got to do it that day. Coffee, we got like a week or two. Not as intense, but it does create some labor needs. And sometimes I think some of the labor constraints are people willing to pay. I think if you're going to pay minimum wage, you will have labor constraints. But if we can get a crop where you can pay a little bit more, your labor pool kind of broadens a bit.
And I'm really intrigued, too, that this ultimately that we can go back to a farmer, let alone the variety of the coffee beans that you have, and that you can go back to a farmer. Someday, Jay, I'd like to be able to go into my favorite coffee shop and say, I want some of Jay Ruskie's coffee. How are you going to create that story, that link for people that want to understand now where the coffee came from, how it was grown, and some of the farmers that are actually producing it?
Well, you're a big help to that right now.
Well, I'm trying.
I mean,
you get one new buyer right now. I'm going to for sure try to chase the coffee down.
Yeah. I think we're at a point now where we have some resources to start educating the consumer. I mean, I did farmers markets for 27 years. And that was like, for what I see in the food system in California, that was a way in which a consumer was able to almost have an expectation of understanding their food and start saying, oh, there's so much behind it, and then have right. a faith behind it. I feel like I'm an ambassador or curator for these farmers to the consumer. That's what Fringe needs to do. And so I want to do two things. One, continue to sell directly to the farmer, or to the consumer through our online at fringecoffee.com. But the second thing is I have a goal to open up a winery-like scenario so that we have a couple easier accessible farms so that people can come there, see the coffee plants in the varying stages, look behind the processing and go, wow, you know, that you need that type of equipment. That's how coffee looks when it's drying. And then be able to, you know, if you were here, I would do a full pour over and show you the different aspects of the coffee, because I think the coffee starts right when you grind it. And then hopefully that when someone leaves there, they're like, look at coffee a whole different way. And so I think if we continue in the path that I'm trying to go, that we'll have some opportunities for people coming through California or living in California to go to a coffee farm. And that's the ultimate way, right? I mean, we've been to craft beer, we've been to craft wine. Yeah. I think that's the next step. And so that's one thing I'm doing, is trying to raise capital for all that.
I tell you what, it's exciting what you're doing. I mean, I like seeing across the country. I like seeing farmers finding new products, new ways to be able to maybe add a different crop that they haven't added before, looking at some more versatility. And then I also see this frontier where we've talked about for a long time how farmers aren't, we need to pay more for food maybe in a certain way. But when you're seeing some new marketing channels that are allow the farmers to more directly participate in the success of the product they're growing, that's pretty exciting. We can need more of that. And I think there's not everywhere in the country or North America can grow coffee, but they're trying other things. And I think so even those farmers are maybe looking at some products that they hadn't grown before. If people want to be able to try the coffee or find out more information, where do they look?
FringeCoffee.com. That's Fringe with a J as the first resource. We just started rolling out in the end of September our first coffees of 2020. So that's the where we'll be going. We also have sent out green beans to various roasters that we feel are suited for what we're doing and have excited customers. So our social media will keep that going and announce those. So that's Instagram and Facebook. Seems to be a kind of a media arrangement. We'll probably be starting to talk some other vehicles and outreach as we move forward, talking about tastings. I think Fringe and what we have and I have responsibility to do is try to help people get to the next level of conversation, maybe through vocabulary and experience. And with the days the way they are, we don't have conferences, so we have to go online a bit. And then hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll have some farms for people to visit and continue to expand those experiences. So,
well, I think it's really exciting what you're doing. I'm glad to see coffee getting established here in California. And certainly it's coming at a good time in that all over the country, people are interested in coffee and stories. I was in Cincinnati and they had a coffee weekend, and I went to the conference center and there was a lineup that went all the way around the block of people that wanted to get in. And it was all the coffee roasters in the Ohio River Valley. And, you know, they were asking the same kind of questions. Where'd the coffee come from and how is it roasted? That's really popping up all over the country. It's a good time to be getting into coffee, it seems to me. And in fact, I think that it's a good time for me to go get into coffee. That's a conversation when you're talking about food and drink all the time. The problem is I want to eat and drink all the time. And Jay Ruske, I really appreciate your being on Farm to Table Talk. Good luck with what you're doing, and we'll have to check back and have another conversation sometime.
I do appreciate the ear, and your questions are great. And I just like to appreciate all those coffee consumers that's taking their coffee to the next level.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.